Good afternoon, everybody. This is Asaf Romorowski welcoming you again to our latest edition of during COVID-19 of our ongoing conference calls. And this afternoon, we have the privilege and opportunity to have our board member, colleague, and friend, Donna Robinson Devine. Her full bio was listed on the invitation. I will just say that Donna has been the Morningstar Family Professor of Jewish Studies and Professor of Government, now emeritus at Smith College. She's been deeply involved in teaching Middle East politics, involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict, has done a lot of work on these topics in women and feminism and in the Middle East. And so it's really a great pleasure to have Donna with us this afternoon. We also have, I know, Alex Jaffe, as always, with us, and the three of us are going to be talking this afternoon about, Donna will be addressing really the ongoing conundrum or challenge of how to win an Israeli election and why, and how to maybe stop the Israelis from going to a fourth attempt to have an election in Middle East politics, which is always an entertaining, fun game to watch. But again, there's a lot at stake now, especially during the pandemic. Let me just set up a few ground rules, as always, and so people know what the format will be. Donna will talk for about 20 minutes, and then we'll open up the floor to as many questions as you may have, and we encourage as many as possible. If you are logged in through the computer, you will see, and those of you who have been with us before know, there is a hand icon. If you click on the icon, I'll be able to unmute you and you can ask your question. You'll be able to also write in a question through the chat form online. And of course, if we don't get to your question today, you can always email us at our email, bdsmonitor@spme.org, bdsmonitor@spme.org. And without further ado, Donna, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Asaf. Thank you for all you do in giving me the opportunity to talk about the three Israeli elections. I thought it might be useful if I started off by talking arithmetically. The Israelis are just finishing their third election on March 2nd, and their third attempt to form a government. They share this number, since we're talking about arithmetic, they share this number with one other country in the Middle East that is also making its third attempt to form a government, and that is Iraq. But I don't think they would like to be in that company, actually. The first election was called in on April 2019. And to win an Israeli election, just basically, Israel is a parliamentary system, which means the parliament is supreme. And I'll talk about, I'll get back to that in just a minute. There are 120 seats in the Knesset. And out of the people and parties elected to the Knesset, because Israeli voters vote for party lists. They don't vote directly for individuals. Out of the particular political parties that are elected to the 120-seated Knesset, you need a vote of 61, obviously a majority, to form the coalition of parties that comprise the government. Thus far, to just make an overall generalization, while there have been three elections thus far, unless something has gone on in the last second, no grouping of parties has been able to mobilize 61 votes for that government. Hence the reason why the April election created the need or was followed by a September election, which was followed by one in March. Now, just to continue talking about numbers, the Israeli electorate is one, in some ways it's considered for us political scientists, most big democracy. It's one constituency. They're not separated as a parliamentary system is in Great Britain into individual constituencies. So everybody has access to the same list of political parties and individuals for casting their vote. It's one large national constituency. The political parties have the opportunity to gain entry into the Knesset, you need a minimum of 3.25% of the votes, which amounts to essentially roughly four seats. So for the most part, every party that gained entry into the Israeli parliament was able to get at least four seats. If you have more votes than are required to equal four seats, but are not equal to another seat, some parties make what are called surplus agreements with other parties, so that if both parties have surplus votes, but neither has enough to gain an extra seat, then the votes are combined and given to the larger party. So there have been in the past roughly three groupings for surplus voting. Likud, the party of Benjamin Netanyahu, has generally speaking made an arrangement with the right Yamima, the party of Naftali Bennett, and other religious Zionists, the general religious Zionist group. Blue and White, the party of Benny Gantz, the electoral alliance of Benny Gantz, has forged an agreement generally with Labor. And Shas and United Torah also have had an agreement. The April election produced 35 seats for Netanyahu's Likud and 35 seats for Blue and White, but neither party was able to forge 61 votes to form a government. So the only thing that was the 21st Knesset. That was the election to the 21st Knesset. The only thing the 21st Knesset did was to dissolve itself. It was sworn in, it dissolved itself, it called another election. Now, when you call another snap election, it can occur no later than 5 months from the time the Knesset is dissolved. And each person, the president, Ruvi Rivlin, is the person who calls on someone to try to form a government. And he generally does it by asking the heads of particular political parties whom they would prefer to see as prime minister and to take on the initiative to form a government. In the first election in 2019, Bibi went first because more heads of parties wanted him than wanted Benny Gantz, even though there were 35. Each person charged with the responsibility of forming a government has 28 days and sometimes can ask for an extension of 14 days. Bibi used all of that time, was unable to form a government, largely because of Avigdor Lieberman, who wanted only a nationalist unity government and stipulated certain demands with respect to the ultra-Orthodox. And so, in a sense, his refusal to go into a government led to the second election, you might call it a do-over, which was held on September 17th, 2019. In that election, the party configurations were different because what had been an independent party led by the Minister of Finance, Moshe Kahlon, joined the Likud as a part of the party. In April, there were divisions among the various Arab parties. They joined together in the second election and the third. The results of the second election were very interesting. Blue and White came out with 33 seats, Likud 32. But the number of seats that Likud won actually represented a significant loss of support because they had wrapped in another party. So it would have been they were expected to go up, but instead they went, they obviously lost, objectively lost three seats, and they were one under Blue and White. Still, there was no, neither block of voting, if you want to call it center left, center right, neither block of voting was able to mobilize 61 votes. And again, Avigdor Lieberman's party was in a slightly stronger position, and he was more insistent than ever, adding to that it be a national unity government and that there needed to be more stipulations to curb the power of the ultra-Orthodox. With the failure to form a government, again, the 22nd Knesset dissolved and called a third election, which might have been held, and I think perhaps appropriately in terms of what was going on, might have been held on Purim of 2020. But there is an exception if the time period falls on a Jewish holiday. National holiday they have a chance to change it. And so the last and most recent election was held on March 2nd with the Likud earning 36 seats in the Knesset, Blue and White only 33, but the joint Arab group of parties had 15 seats instead of 13. And there was a significant increase in numbers voting, percentages of voting. So even though there were predictions that people would get tired of voting and not vote, that didn't take place. And the March 2nd voting was already under the shadow of the coronavirus, where because of Netanyahu's early insistence on what we now know as social distancing and quarantines, there were people who were coming to vote at special places because they had been diagnosed with the virus and were contagious, and you saw people counting the votes who had to be covered the proper garb for protection against infection. So it was already in addition to political crisis that, of course, has all sorts of consequences for the economy. But in addition to the political crisis, there was also a health crisis as well that was revolving. Now, what's going on here? Let me just say a few words about the political party system. The political party system has been weakened and fragmented ever since the Oslo Accords, and the notion of, you know, peace or what to do about the Oslo Accords or about the territories and all those kinds of issues have made it less possible for even the larger parties to earn 40 seats, which they once could, or to earn enough seats so that they have a better chance to forming a coalition. And to his credit, there's no one who knows the system and who can maneuver the system better than Benjamin Netanyahu. I think that everybody can agree on that notion. And to his credit, from the very beginning of these three elections that took place, Benjamin Netanyahu recognized that he needed to expand the right-wing base if he was going to counter his opposition. His opposition, the blue and white, was an electoral alliance that comprised former generals like and chiefs of staff like Benny Gantz, Moshe Yaalon, Gabi Ashkenazi. But these were people who were charged with army duties and were distinguished generals, but they also were very much against Netanyahu continuing as prime minister because of what was initially the possibility of indictments, and then by the third election, real indictments. They believed they were standing up for the rule of law and for decency in government. And so what united all of blue and white was their opposition to Netanyahu, not so much an agreement on particular policies. The leadership, the military leadership of that party was joined by Yair Lapid's party, which had been around for a while, Yesh Atid, which had once been in a government years ago with Benjamin Netanyahu, and which believed also that there had to be a stand taken against his continuing in office, given the legal issues. And Yesh Atid comprised kind of the foot soldiers for the blue and white movement, because these were people, these generals were people who really didn't understand how to mobilize for an election, how to run an election. You know, they didn't have branches of parties in different towns and different villages. So the Yesh Atid that provided that component for that movement, and there was also a former member of the Histadrut, Nissenkorn, a former head of the Histadrut, who also joined them with some leverage about the street, Main Street. It was generally acknowledged that there wasn't much of a policy difference between the Likud and the right, and blue and white and the center left. So what Benjamin Netanyahu did, and what seems to have been an accurate depiction of the election and the series of elections, was to realize that you needed a block of votes on the right that would stick together, and it needed to be large enough to be able to elect enough people, get enough people into the Knesset to form a government. And he was always, he was conscious of the fact that the parties, the right, the religious right, voters to produce the kind of mandate he wanted to get reelected as prime minister and as the person who forms the government. So he was constantly pushing the religious Zionists to include the former Kahanis, to include groups that were sort of outside the mainstream of either Likud in one fashion or another, or were considered too extreme. And he could never bring the extremes in without alienating some people that were already within the religious Zionist movement. So it was kind of fractured. And he also, was the case that within these groups, within these blocks, they ended up, if they didn't grow, they cannibalized one another. So Likud, in gaining 35 seats in April, cannibalized the new right, the party that Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked had formed to bring in secular and religious, and to be without the rubric of rabbis, but to deal with what they call annexation, the judicial system, the way they wanted. They focused on what they saw as Netanyahu's security failures in the areas next to the Gaza Strip and in all the rockets and the balloons and things like that. And they did not, in the first election, they did not bring in enough votes to even gain entrance into the Knesset. So the feeling was that the Likud siphoned off votes that might have gone to them because people were afraid of the alternative led by Benny Gantz. And the reason they seemed to be afraid of the alternative was not so much that Benny Gantz dramatically opposed the policies of the Likud. He was more or less favorable to the Trump plan. He didn't really diverge in any dramatic way from the other issues, but they're afraid that because his bloc might be dependent on some Arab votes or some left-wing votes, that if he were in power, it would change the policy orientation. The election campaigns, the election campaign that Bibi ran, or the election campaigns, were pretty brutal. He was not only accusing people he had appointed to office, people with whom he had worked, of betraying the values of Zionism and the Jewish state and dependent on Arab votes, but he attacked people personally. And so there were no holes barred in that way. To his credit, for the third election, when he realized that perhaps he lost votes because some people hadn't bothered to go out to vote, Netanyahu is tireless when it comes to campaigning, and he knocked on doors of people who hadn't voted in the second election. And, you can imagine somebody knocks on your door and you open it and it's the prime minister. At any rate, where are we now? The coronavirus, there's sort of good news and bad news for Netanyahu. Netanyahu is given a lot of credit for handling the virus aggressively and handling it well at the beginning, with quarantines, with lockdowns. But I think he knows as well as anybody that to dig a country out of this hole, as many of us in the United States are facing, to dig a country out of this hole is going to take a lot of unpopular decisions. They're going to be decisions, particularly when you have to prioritize security over other areas, that some people are going to be hurt. So on the one hand, it would make sense to have as broad a coalition as possible. On the other hand, because he's been given high marks for his initial moves, he may feel emboldened to strike a hard bargain, or even to go into a fourth election. He has thus far been able, what happened after the third election was that Benny Gantz was given because he got party heads equaling 61 seats in the Knesset, he was given the first opportunity to form a government. The problem with his backing was that of the 61 votes that said, yes, let's give him the first opportunity, at least three of those votes, which puts him under 61, at least three of those votes said, if he forms a government that depends on the joint Arab list, we will not sit in it. One person was in an alignment with the old Labour Party, and Orly Levy Abacasis of the Gesher Party. Two other people were in the particular party led by Moshe Yaalon that was in the alliance with Blue and White. Hendel, who had been the media advisor for Netanyahu and Tzvi Hauser, who had been his cabinet secretary, they had been dismissed by Netanyahu several years ago when there was a sexual harassment complaint against one of his close associates. They went to the civil service. They followed proper procedures in reporting it, and Netanyahu was very angry that they didn't come to him first, so they fired him. Now, Gantz, there was this attempt to form a government, but Gantz decided, given the his knowledge that he really didn't have 61 seats for a government, what Gantz decided to do was to ask for the Knesset to meet, so that the expectation was the Knesset would meet and he would be able to control the both the committee assignments and the priorities of the committee, and there might be, or there was expected to be, a proposal to prevent a person who was indicted from forming a government. I mean, that's what you saw in the media. The question, of course, is when you pass a law, a basic law that seems to have constitutional status, normally in Israel, it's not put in force immediately. It's put in force in the next election cycle. But even beyond that, the then Speaker of the Knesset initially refused to call the Knesset into session, seemingly triggering a constitutional crisis. The Supreme Court meeting as the Court of Justice insisted that the Knesset meet. And then Edelstein, the Speaker of the Knesset, resigned in order not to have the Knesset do anything before a government was formed. Normally, the procedure is a government is formed so that the Knesset Speaker reflects the government, the government's position, is not in opposition to the government. So there was some precedent for that. The Supreme Court weighed in a second time and said, no, the Knesset should meet, and the oldest member of the Knesset, who was Amir Peretz, elected as speaker, and then went into negotiations, which obviously broke up the electoral alliance with Yesh Atid, with Telem, and the three people who had refused in principle ever to sit in a government that was backed by the Arabs. One has already, Orly Levy Abekatsis has already said she would support Netanyahu as prime minister. And the other two, Hendel and Hauser, said if Gantz goes in, they will support Gantz. So Gantz is now not the head of a party or an electoral alliance with 33 seats. He's only the head of a party with, I don't know, 16 or 17. So he's been vilified in the press as someone who's a flyer, who doesn't know how to deal with the system. As there was an article by Michael Kaplow that some of you may have seen that said, if Moses had negotiated with Pharaoh the way Gantz had negotiated with Netanyahu, that we'd still be slaves in Egypt. But nevertheless, to my mind, he didn't have great options. People said he should have waited a bit longer to negotiate. He certainly should have told the other members of the Electoral Alliance what he was doing. And he's justifying it by the coronavirus and the emergency and the need for emergency measures and for some sort of unity. No less, the person who's really vilified his tactical skills was Avigdor Lieberman, who's probably the more responsible than any other single politician for the three elections in Israel. But if you look at these three elections, had Avigdor Lieberman backed Benny Gantz in the second election of September 2019, we may not have had to have a third, just saying that. Okay, I'll leave it at that, and happy to take questions.
Great, wonderful. So thank you, Donna, for that extensive overview and trying to explain how Israeli politics works. Maybe three times is a charm, or what they call in Israel, the third time you deserve an ice cream, but hopefully preventing a fourth. So with that being said, the floor is now open. As I mentioned and when we started, if you have a question, please hit the hand icon on your name, and I'll be able to unmute you. You can also write in a question. But why don't we start it off? Alex, do you want to start off with the first question?
Sure. Well, thank you for the overview. It's you need a scorecard to keep track of the players. Let me ask a slightly broader question, and that is that has to do with the fate of labor and the Israeli left in general. Labor, I think, got three seats in March, and now they're talking about all sorts of mergers. What happened? What does it mean? And where is it going to go?
I think to some extent, labor historically became equivalent to the establishment in Israel. They were the founders. They were the first to take advantage of whatever opportunities were there. And they had certainly they certainly weren't, you know, for a very long time, following any strict kind of socialist policy. They weren't singing the Internacional anymore, the way they once did in the 1920s and the 1930s. But what happened to labor was essentially that they were cannibalized and have been cannibalized by center parties. And so you still have some numbers who had been part of Meretz, Merav Michaeli, and, you still have some people who are trying to revive labor. But Amir Peretz, he was head of the Histadrut. He was, one of the old labor people, and he moved away significantly, and at least the rumors, you never know what to believe, but he seems to be willing to go into a coalition with Netanyahu. Labor disappeared partly because its institutions no longer were adequate to meet the needs for which they had been founded. You needed a different kind of healthcare system. You needed a different kind of labor system. Even before 67 changed the geography and the economy, you had some of the bedrock and iconic institutions of labor, like the kibbutzim and the moshavim, losing money, needing more and more support. So either those institutions had to change and change radically or disappear. And so the party itself was no longer a vehicle for gaining power and prestige, and no longer became attractive.
Great. Alex, do you have a follow-up, or do you want, I'm going to read the, or you want me to read the next question?
No, please read away. If I think of something, I'll
okay. Finish. All good. So we have a question from the audience. Donna Eric Slykoff is asking, what are the current issues that Netanyahu and Gantz are trying to get an agreement on, and can you predict how those issues will be settled? I guess.
I only predict about the past, or and not the present or the future. But so again, according to newspaper reports, the two principal issues were annexation of parts of Area C of the West Bank, which are allowed in the Trump plan. And the question of the judiciary. The question of the judiciary is, let me say a few words because there are a couple of components to that. We tend in the United States, or very often when you see articles about the Supreme Court, people tend to write about it as if it has the same powers and authority that the American Supreme Court has. That is, it does have authority to invalidate laws, but this is a parliamentary system. So you don't have co-equal branches of government the way you presumably have, at least according to the Federalist Papers, in the United States, or according to our constitutional principles. So technically, in a parliamentary system, parliament is supreme, and even if a law is invalidated for one or another reason by the Supreme Court, the parliament can re-pass, you know, some version of the law going forward in the aftermath. If there was some part of the law that was either technically incorrect or violated some ethical standards. Now, one of the basic laws passed during the Rabin administration was a law on called on the basic dignity. And so The Supreme Court had tried to use that in a way to reinforce the notion of civil rights and human rights within the state. Some of their decisions were somewhat controversial, but and that led to the nation-state law as a kind of counterbalance, saying that, okay, civil liberties in Israel ought to be made consistent with a nation state that was identifiably Jewish, however that was going to be defined. So that the Supreme Court in Israel has invalidated laws, but it's also been historically very conscious that it can't step out in exactly the way the American Supreme Court has. So while there are many, many appeals to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, I think, has been conscious of not wanting to do something that would trigger absolute opposition from the Knesset to sort of curb their power. There are people like Ayelet Shaked and people in the Yamin HaChadash, the New Right Party, and some others on the right, who have wanted to change the procedure for appointing Supreme Court justices, who have wanted to have the Supreme Court justice, people appointed to the Supreme Court having to pass through a kind of consent of the parliament. Now, Supreme Court is appointments are controlled largely by the legal system itself, with some political input, not total political input. So there's been a question of how to appoint Supreme Court justices. And also, at this point, there's a question of what would happen if the Supreme Court, has already been asked to weigh in on whether an indicted prime minister can form a new government. Up until now, the Supreme Court has said it's theoretical. It's too soon. We can't. You know, you have to come back when it's a real issue. And Netanyahu is afraid that if he does have 61 plus votes to form a government, that the Supreme Court will weigh in and say he cannot be the prime minister because he has these indictments already looming against him. We don't know, there's at least one, a couple of newspaper reports that Benny Gantz has said that if the Supreme Court were to do something like that, he would vote to disband the Knesset and call a new election. I don't know if the Supreme Court would want to weigh in, given all of these circumstances. But those are the issues. There are principal issues, and then there are personal issues that have to do with the Supreme Court.
Great. Thank you. I'm looking for more questions. Let me ask a question, Donna. So, I mean, you know, with everything, you know, with the internal intricacies of the Israeli elections, coming, to the American Jewish community and what people see here, there's obviously, one could argue that, the American Jewish left is more aligned with merits, whereas, there's not much left, as you pointed out, between whatever is left of the left, post, I would say, 1998, going forward. It's basically a debate between right and maybe right of center. That gap, that is much narrower in the Israeli conversation, is much wider here in the States. And that's a lot of the lost in translation. To that end, there's still, the animosity that we see towards Netanyahu and the state of Israel. There's not really an understanding, of this intricacy How do you see this playing out as it relates to our own presidential campaign going forward, you know, as we lead towards November?
One thing before I get to your question, one thing that I should have mentioned about the Trump plan, we don't know, given what's going on in the United States, if Trump would want to pursue, you know, the Trump plan by November. You know, who knows? He may have other things he wants to emphasize, wants to make sure things are quiet in the Middle East. And Netanyahu has been very conscious, I think, of, I think he understands that Trump is sort of volatile when it comes to policy making. And I think he's been careful not only to praise Trump and to see him as a supporter, he's helped him in terms of the plan, but also not to violate anything, not to trigger any difference or animosity. So one doesn't know what would happen to the issue of annexation or not annexation, you know, are happy with the parts of the Trump plan that call for annexation, but unhappy with parts of the Trump plan that call for demilitarized Palestinian state. So the right in Israel is not all agreed on the Trump plan and on that part of the policy. I think the American Jewish community is solidly Democratic. My sense is that Trump is not running against Vice President Biden. He's running against the virus. And whatever happens with regard to how people feel we've returned or we've constrained the virus enough, we can take a chance on returning to the street and, you know, to shopping and, you know, to all the things that we need to do, to jobs, that will determine his future, and it will determine the future of a lot of alliances and a lot of what happens to the global distribution of power. As for the American Jewish community, I continue to think that the focus should be on understanding Israel from within and understanding its culture, its art, what a Jewish state has given to the American Jewish community, and that will go on regardless of the politics. Someday even Netanyahu won't be prime minister.
Someday, yeah, exactly. We don't know when, but thank you. Alex, do you want to go for the last question with keeping my eye on the clock here as far as Donna's remarks?
Sure. let me just follow up on that last point then about the relationship or the perceptions of the American Jewish community, which is aging, which is increasingly, where the only increasing demographic is in the Orthodox sector, which has trended towards the Democratic Party very, very solidly since the 20s, certainly, if not certainly the 30s. But which is seeing its political power being challenged every which way. How do you think American Jews are even supposed to comprehend Israeli politics, viewing it from a distance, given the language skills, given the cultural divides, predominantly Ashkenazi, an aging Ashkenazi American community that is largely still very much Democratic and on the left, trying to understand a much younger Sephardi Mizrahi oriented society that has completely different perceptions on everything: culture, politics, family, religion, the future, the place of pluralism, the place of multiculturalism, and so on and so on and so on. How do we bridge this divide in order to create a global Jewish community? That's a separate goal, but in order for the two communities to support one another.
I don't know that I have the answer to that. I sit outside the Orthodox community personally, but I'm fairly observant. I'm sort of on the traditional end of the conservative movement, but I see some wonderful things happening in music, in art, even in using religious language to speak to contemporary issues. I should be pessimistic on bridging gap. I'm not. I have to tell you that there's always been a sort of gap between Zionism and the diaspora, and sometimes it was to negate the diaspora, Shlilat HaGalut, to bring people into creating a Jewish national home and a Jewish state. But I think that people create identity from their own daily lives, their own interactions, their own knowledge, their own understanding of even their small communities and creating larger and larger communities. We have Israelis who live in the United States or in Canada and who write in Hebrew. You have Arabs. Ayman Oda, the head of the Joint List, where just as the head of his smaller party in the first election, when he endorsed Benny Gantz for prime minister, wrote a letter to Ruby Rivlin quoting Psalms, which incorporated in the Hallel prayer, Evan Masu Habonim, and you wanted to say Hayatah Nifla'ot. There's a language that's coming through with little by little that I have to believe will ultimately be recognized.
Good. Alex, any follow-up or?
I will only say that I'm cheered by your optimism. And
optimism is good, and I think that's a good also way to end our call today. Unfortunately, time is short. I'm trying to keep just be cognizant of people's times. First of all, I want to thank you, Donna, for joining us today, and I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and insights. Thank you, Alex, as always, for sharing your thoughts and insights. And above all, thank you everybody here for joining us this afternoon. We are here for you. This is why we are here, to have these ongoing conversation on topics of the day. Again, I want to stress that, and to hope that everybody is safe and healthy wherever they are in these unique and challenging times. And, part of we're looking to have these calls to engage with you while we're all at home. So I thank you for taking the time to be with us this afternoon. And we will again send another call in about a week or so to have another another call, and hope you'll be able to join us again there as well. Final remarks, Donna, before we end this afternoon.
No, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Great. Well, thank you again for everybody for joining us. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Donna. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this afternoon, and wish you a good afternoon, and stay healthy and safe. Take care.
Thank you. You too.